Cinnamon, where you gonna run to? Cinnamon, where you gonna run to? Where you gonna run to? All on that day, will I run to the rock? Please hide me and run to the rock. Please hide me and run to the rock. Please hide me, Lord, all on that day. But the rock cried out, I can't hide you, the rock cried out. I can't hide you, the rock cried out. I ain't gonna hide you, God, all on that day. I said, rock, what's the matter with you, rock? Don't you see I need you, rock? Lord, 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 all on that day. So I ran to the river. It was bleeding around to the sea. It was bleeding around to the sea. It was bleeding all on that day. So I ran to the river. It was boiling around to the sea. It was boiling around to the sea. It was boiling all on that day. So I ran to the Lord.
That was Nina Simone with Sinner Man, one of her legendary songs. This is Lead Stories. I'm Utrice Lead, and it's Wednesday, November the 14th, a good day to recalibrate our political compasses. And we're in luck, because our calibrator today is Sam Smith, an award-winning journalist, activist, and social critic, and editor of the Progressive Review. Sam Smith has been at the forefront of new ideas and new politics for more than 40 years, editing alternative publications since 1964, probably one of the ones who's been at it for the longest in the country. He has helped to found six organizations, was one of the organizers of the Association of State Green Parties, the precursor to the National Green Party today, and in the 1970s was a co-founder of the DC Statehood Party, which held public office for more than two decades. He's the author of several books, among them the one I like best, Sam Smith's Great American Political Repair Manual, and Shadows of Hope, a Freethinker's Guide to Politics in the Time of Clinton. He was the first writer, in fact, to call for statehood for Washington, D.C. His book, Captive Capital, Colonial Life in Modern Washington, explained how statehood could be achieved without a constitutional amendment being necessary. Sam, thanks so much for being with us today. Delighted
Thank
to have you.
Thank you for inviting me.
Well, it's been a long time since we talked, but I'm delighted to have you with us today. Well, let's start from your vantage point, how you read this election, or still are reading this election.
Well, I saw this election, I think, as terribly important in not just as a another game to fight, but a really historically important one. And the reason for that was that the Republican Party was engaged in something that we really haven't seen since the post-Reconstruction era, which was an attempt to reverse decades of politics. So it was very, very critical. I mean, if Romney had won, it would have changed this country just inordinately.
Well, it is waiting in the wings, don't you think? The Republicans have learned a lesson. They are sufficiently jarred, and they are recalibrating, to use the word I used earlier, in order to reverse their fortunes come the next presidential election.
Well, I think they may think that. I'm not sure they're going to succeed, because history has a curious way of moving on. And I think that one of the things they've lost out on is the strength of their scare rhetoric. Because what happened was that the majority of people said, no, we're not scared, we're going to do something else. And once that happens, it's a little hard to do that again. So they're going to have to try something new.
But if you look at the atmosphere in which this election occurred, and quite a few indicators signaled that there was trouble, there was a huge, and still is, and is growing apparently, a huge racial divide. And although Barack Obama did win, he lost a lot of votes among whites who previously had voted for him in 2008. Surveys showed that America is at its most racially divisive in many, many years. And this was a kind of a backlash as well. There are a number of people who did not vote, who millions of people decided not to vote. So the country, in a way, the nature of the campaign and leading up to it, because I would say that from the moment Barack Obama was elected, you saw evidence of this turn toward vitriol and the expression directly and indirectly of a really nasty racist tenor.
Yeah, you did. But again, this is a situation of what were they able to get away with? And this sort of stuff, it happens in a vacuum, in a sense, because it's a sign that the other side is very weak. And I think for the past 30 years, liberal America has been very weak. And the key point, if you want to overcome things like the racist element, the best way to do that is to get people focused on their real self-interest, which is an economic issue. If you go back all the way to slavery, you find a very few people in the South actually own slaves, whites own slaves. But they managed to convince poor whites that blacks were their problem. And that continued after the Civil War, it continued right up to the Civil Rights Movement. And now the Republicans in this last election essentially sort of adopted the same approach. And how do you beat that? Well, history shows that the way you beat it is by getting people to get off the kick of blaming somebody else and look at their own self-interest, which is basically an economic one.
To what degree do you see the liberal element in the United States actually succeeding at this?
I don't see the liberal element succeeding. I see progressives doing it. And people, what I call progressive populists.
What's the difference?
I think of liberals as essentially having become a demographic rather than a movement. I think I think one of the problems historically that we've got, and you can find this in the women's movement, you can find it in the black movement, you can find it in the white liberal movement, is that precisely because liberal programs succeeded, people are doing better than they were, say, in the 1930s or 40s. And so so you get a different sort of politics. You don't have the passion for economic issues. If you go back and you look at what one person in the Franklin Roosevelt administration, Francis Perkins, his labor secretary, was pushing, it's extraordinary. You know, minimum wage, a shorter work week, Social Security, health care. And then ask yourself, well, what in the past 30 years has the liberal movement done along these lines? And you don't come up with much. So that I think we have to basically create a new wing of politics, which I think of as progressive populist, and go after some of these issues.
Using the same question as it applies to progressives, do you see a difference in approach and a difference in turf gain on this question?
I think there's a lack of I can't really explain it because I'm an older guy, and I'm the son of a New Dealer, a guy who worked for the New Deal for 16 years, so I was sort of raised on this stuff, and it just sort of seems natural to me. But I don't find it around. And so that when I'm looking at the situation, I come up with ideas like I remember back during the campaign in 2008, one of the things I proposed was that the Democrats come out with a proposal to limit credit card interest rates to their levels in the 1980s, which would be single digit. Now, you would probably have 95% approval among Americans for that. But why isn't that sort of thing on the table? More recently, I suggested something like you have a veterans public works program. You end the war in Afghanistan, you bring the veterans back, and you use the money that you've saved on not having to build more Humvees. You use that for a public works program, and you give veterans priorities for the jobs in the works programs. Now, the thing about that is that's a nice sort of cross-cultural, cross-ideological approach. But those sort of things, you know, they don't even get discussed these days.
But I come back to this theme. I mean, progressives, liberals, whatever label that we choose to call them, and we will use your term progressive, there still seems to be an obstinacy or a hesitancy about dealing squarely and upfront with the racial question. And this is at the root of a lot of dissonance, political dissonance. This is why coalitions are not working. I don't know how else to say it, but I continue to see the same fault lines even within movements that say they're progressive. They haven't moved away from this race model at all.
Well, one of the problems is that if you try to approach that issue as sort of a philosophical or ideological one, you don't get far. And that's what's sort of difficult about it. I mean, you have to deal with specific cases of unfairness. I mean, that's what the civil rights movement did. That's what the civil rights legislation did. And you have to look and you have to say, well, who's being screwed and what can we do to cure that? And I think that once you find, for example, there are a lot of issues in which poor whites and poor blacks have much more in common than they realize. But nobody's telling them that. No one's explaining that. I mean, look who's in prison. I mean, what if you had an alliance between young white and black males to change, to reform the prison system? See, that's the sort of approach I take rather than taking the moral approach, you know, and say, well, you've got to change your attitude, because just from my experience, people don't react to that very well.
How did you see Barack Obama, his first term? How did you, from your vantage point, how did you interpret his first term?
Well, I was quite critical of him because I did some research on him. And I guess one of the first questions I had was, there's a Chicago story about the guy goes into the alderman's office and is looking for a job. And they ask him, well, who sent you? And he said, nobody sent me. I just came in. And the guy behind the desk says, well, we don't want nobody. Nobody sent. So when you got someone who was a state senator and in 4 years is running for president, you have to ask yourself, well, who sent him? And when you look at the record, you find the stains and the evidence of the Democratic Leadership Council, for example, which is a group that was started to essentially turn the Democrats into a sort of Republican light. And Bill Clinton was their first choice, and I think they had a fair amount to do with Barack Obama's rise, too. And interestingly, the guy who's being mentioned for Secretary of Defense, John Kerry, is another one of their babies. See, so, but the media doesn't report this. The media didn't report, for example, that Mrs. Harriman had 100 sessions at her house to essentially vet Democratic candidates during the Clinton years. And that's how Clinton sort of made it to the top. And we don't hear those stories. But then the other thing is that if you looked at Obama's record, he just didn't come across.
Before I move on, I just want you to just go back to that. Mrs. Harriman, you're referring to Mrs. Everill Harriman?
Yeah, right.
Okay. The wife of the, he was then what, Secretary of State, was he, or ambassador? I'm not sure
this was long after that. I mean, she had been ambassador, but she was very well connected with the Democratic Leadership Council, and she had these sessions at her house in which lobbyists and others could come and sort of vet the potential presidential candidates. And this is something that the public generally doesn't hear about, why did Clinton do so well? I mean, what had he done for anybody?
What's your answer?
Well, I didn't have an answer. That's why I was curious. And I had the same question about Barack Obama, and I think that's the I guess in part it's in the nature of our politics today that we are going more with personalities and less with real politics, so that we don't really care whether a politician has done anything.
Well, it's interesting you should raise the Clinton issue, because this is a pet peeve of mine. First of all, I think, you know, Bill Clinton and Hillary Clinton have done a fantastic job of playing a kind of sleight of hand. People think they're very liberal and they're such good people. But I continue to say, wherever you see a Clinton, you know there are at least 100 agendas at work. And they all have to do with money and power.
Absolutely.
So explain the Clinton factor, because one of the things that you did at the Progressive Review was, in fact, you unmasked the Clintons.
Well, it was actually sort of a matter of just getting increasingly curious about it, because I had covered corruption over the years, and I got looking into Arkansas, and I said, wow, this is really something. And just to give you just a little sense of the aura of the place, there was a drug pilot who used to bring drugs into Arkansas, and he said it was his favorite place to bring drugs. And somebody asked him why, and he said, "Well," he said, "I'll give you an example." He said, "Once I landed in the pasture, and my pickup was a state trooper in a marked car." And that's something which I'd say most people aren't familiar with that sort of politics, or the fact that the economic development agency that Clinton developed in Arkansas dumped $50 million into the Cayman Islands, you know, long before we'd ever heard of the Cayman Islands. And you say, well, what in the world is going on down there? And so it's a fascinating story, a very, very complex one. But the lesson you come out of it was that, and I think it's important to understand that corrupt as Arkansas was, that the role of and drugs played a huge role in it, that corrupt as it was, the politician's role is just sort of be smilingly sort of supervising the whole scene. He's not in deep into the operation. And if you've ever been to a movie about the Prohibition days, you know how the politicians are in those movies. Well, that's sort of the way it is and with the drug trade, I think, too. And I think we have to be very realistic. We're not realistic about the drug trade, but I mean, the best estimates I've seen is that the drug industry is roughly the size of the pharmaceutical industry. Now, ask yourself, how can you have an industry that big that doesn't exercise any political influence?
Interesting question. As it relates to Hillary Clinton and Bill Clinton and Barack Obama, what kind of connections have you been able to establish and that are troubling, I would say?
That are what?
That are troubling.
That are troubling. Well, I would say that maybe it's the fact that Barack Obama doesn't have the connections that would be comforting. If you ask yourself this, you know, which of his cabinet appointments do you really feel enthusiastic about?
An inordinate number of them are holdovers from the Clinton administration, Clintonites. His advisors are a lot of Clintonites around him.
That's right.
A lot of the programs that this administration started pushing were Clinton's programs.
That's right. And the problem is that it's not a matter of looking for evil so much as it is looking for the system just being maintained. If you look at someone like Rubin, who was Clinton's Secretary of Treasury, I mean, his connections with Wall Street were just unbelievable. And once you have that sort of system, you don't need any dirty dealings. All you need is a phone call, a nod, you know, it can be done in a very informal and easy fashion.
Do you
and
think?
And the interesting thing is that when you look at the history of this recent recession, the people who tried to call some of the shots on it were people like Elizabeth Warren and Sheila Blair. It's interesting, they were women, and they got nowhere because they were attempting to enter the old boys' club.
Do you think that the first term Obama, let's just say, was an Obama tutored or reliant on a lot of other people around him, and this second term he would emerge more as an independent person, carving his own way, calling his own shots, more so than in the first term?
I tend to doubt it. Because one thing people forget about politicians is that you may say, well, this is his last term, he's a free agent now. No, he's not a free agent because he's got to think of the rest of his career.
The president began this week to meet with various groups. Yesterday, he met with labor union leaders. Today, he's meeting with the business sector. Tomorrow, he meets with members of Congress. How do you read the meeting so far?
Well, I was looking at the labor union meeting, and my gut reaction, it was pretty soft. There was no promise there to preserve Social Security, for example, or Medicare. And these are really over the next coming weeks, these are the really important issues, I think, are Social Security and Medicare. And there are some other ones which don't get much attention. Let me just throw one out for you. I was stunned to see, I live in Maine, and I was stunned to see that our Tea Party governor expressed concern over how sequestering was going to hurt the state because funds would be caught coming to the state, Now, this is something that people forget, is that when you cut the federal government, you also cut state and local government because there are all sorts of programs that filter down. And this is something the Republicans have gotten everybody so trained to think that if you just cut the federal budget, you're only cutting the federal budget, and it's just not true. So that's another aspect of an issue that people really should be talking more about. And I think it would be very useful for progressives to talk about it because it gets people who just think it's a simple matter of federal versus local that it isn't. It's more complicated than that.
Well, from the list of people invited to these sessions, I see, today you have American Express, Xerox Corporation, Honeywell, Walmart, General Electric, Dow Chemical, Procter & Gamble, Ford Motor Company, Pepsi, Cola Company, IBM, and Chevron. I don't see participation by any group of small businesses, for example. I was expecting that there would be some grouping, maybe Better Business Bureau, a bunch of guys from Maine Incorporated, somebody to speak for that sector that was always talked about. So
no, that's right, and that's the way the game is played in Washington these days. And it's not just it's not just Obama. The thing is that people like Clinton and Obama are really, in many ways, creatures of the system. They're not running it. They're in a position in which they have some initiatives, but they also are under a lot of control. And that's why you had that list you just read sort of indicates that. And you can tell, one of the things that struck me about Obama in his first term was his lack of buddies. A really successful politician has friends and knows how to develop them, has them over to the White House. And there was sort of a formalistic quality to the Obama administration, which my gut reaction was, this isn't very good politics because this isn't the way you get people to come along with you. And if you go back to ancient times and you look at, say the relationship between the Republican leader of the Senate, Everett Dirksen, and the Democratic President Lyndon Johnson, you see a whole different sort of ball game. I mean, it was much more of sort of personal play going on.
Do you get a sense that the president is respected by the party?
Well, who's the party?
His own party, the Democratic Party.
You mean the leadership of it?
Yes.
Gee, I haven't really thought about that much. What's your reaction?
Well, I'm amazed. I mean, I'm just listening to the debates, for example. The debates gave me a very good clue. And press conferences that are held by cabinet members and officials and so forth. For example, I never hear them say or give the impression that they're conscious of the fact that they're working for the president. You get the sense, you know, Biden talks about we all the time. We, I mean, he's a vice president. Mm-hmm. So you would expect him to say, well, the president thinks so and so and so, and I share that view. I listen to the language. Hillary Clinton very seldom even mentioned him by name.
Yeah, well, I think that sort of goes to what I was saying before about not having buddies. I mean, I'm a musician, and I know that you can know all the notes and all the chords, and it's still got a swing. And one of the things that I find about Obama, which is non-ideological, is that it doesn't feel right. Just for sort of reasons you're talking about. You know, you can sense when there's enthusiasm, you can sense when there's a people all on the same wavelength going in the same direction. But there's something which is sort of formalistic about this administration, which I think has been part of its liability, because you can't develop passion with that. Mm. I mean, if you have people working for you, and they're not really passionate to the cause, then that doesn't help you much.
Mm-hmm. What should be the marching orders now for those who say they are progressives?
Well, I would say there are a number of things. First of all, I think you got to deal immediately with some of the issues that are coming up, and I'd say Social Security and Medicare are very high on that list. Over the longer run, I think you need to know what progressives stand for. And I think a list of a half dozen priorities reached by progressive groups actually sitting down with each other for a change and coming up with a, you know, like the Tea Party, let people know, you know, what do progressives stand for? It's hard to know at this point. The other thing I'd like to see is a much better understanding in the progressive movement of the importance of local and state government. I think one of the reasons that they don't do better is because there's this tendency to if anybody says anything about wanting something to be done locally, they start talking about states' rights. And that simply isn't true, that all government has to be carried out at different levels. And I think having respect for state and local government would be a big asset. And there are lots of things that could be done that would make that work better. It's this quality of not having a real feel for it. For example, if you're doing a stimulus package, and say I was advising the president on how to handle it, I'd say every sign ought to have your name on it, on one side, and on the other side, the name of the governor or the mayor, regardless of party. And that way, you start to change the politics, you see, because it isn't just Obama. Mm-hmm. And it makes it that much harder for the governor to then say, well, I don't want this. See, it's that sort of thing that I don't think we spend enough time on.
What's the story that you are tracking right now? What's the biggest story you're tracking right now?
Well, I guess it is how we deal with the next 4 years. You know, are there any things that we can be doing? Are there any strengths, sort of hidden strengths? If the problem is that there are a lot of things that you can say should happen, but how do you get them to happen? For example, in my dream world, I'd like to see someone about 20 to 25 years old write a book that would alter the course of young thinking about politics in this country. But, I mean, that's just a dream. But that's the sort of thing, because I think we underrate how important that is. I mean, if I'm a child of the 50s and I lived through the 60s, and I just have this tremendous feeling of how important culture is in making change. And if you don't have that culture, if you don't have people, not a matter of specific political thing, but an attitude, a philosophy, and values, that's really important. And I wish I could find some secret magic way to change that.
Well, we are going to take a break and come back to calls. I'm sure people have calls and questions and comments for you. 1-888-874-4888. This is Lead Stories. Our guest, Sam Smith, the award-winning editor of the Progressive Review. We'll be back right after this. This is Lead Stories. I'm your Trace Lead, and our guest is Sam Smith, editor of the Progressive Review. Your calls and comments at 1-888-874-4888. That's 1-888-874-4888. What do you think would come out of this coming week? With all of the negotiations going on, do you think the Republicans are likely to be a bit more contrite and amenable to negotiating? What do you think is going to happen with this so-called fiscal cliff?
Well, I guess my main concern is that Obama doesn't give in more than he has to. You know, one of the reasons we've gotten to this point, I'd say there are two reasons that don't get enough attention. One was the filibuster. People don't realize this, but the filibuster is a Senate rule, and every new Senate can make its own rules. And when Obama came in with a Democratic Congress, they could have changed the filibuster dramatically, and they didn't. And we've paid a huge price for that. But the second thing is, I think that we live in a culture where increasingly people who come to power, and whether it be in business or in politics, are afraid to lose. And yet one of the best tricks of a good politician is to know when to lose. And because if you lose, you then have an argument. And one of the problems why Obama didn't have a better argument against the Republicans was he hadn't fought hard enough and lost. Like, say, Harry Truman did against the Republicans when he ran for re-election. And so that's one thing I think we have to keep in mind is not just whether you win, but what are the strategic ripe times to lose.
You were one of the organizers of the Association of State Green Parties. What's your take on the performance of third parties in this last go round?
Well, I've been from the start what I call a backyard green, that I have favored green politics at the local and state level. I'm not enthusiastic of running for president because if you look at the history of third parties, they're just not, it's not a successful way to spend your time. And that's the way third parties have made a difference has been as grassroots organizations. You know, at one point we had 70 mayors in this country who were socialists. We had thousands of populist advocates going around the country pushing the populist agendas. The progressives were the same way. And so I've been sort of on the odds with a lot of my green friends on that issue. But I think there's really there's a potential for it. Now, the difficult thing right now is that when we started things like the D.C. Stated Party and the Green Party, one reason was that we were motivated by the fact that there were a lot of movement activity going on, you know, the 60s and all that. But we didn't have really a political manifestation for that. Now we're in sort of a different situation where you have a formal political structure in the Green Party, but you don't have any movement. I think if you had a strong movement and a Green Party, you could really have something going.
Talk to me a bit about the D.C. Statehood Party and the success it had for more than two decades.
Yeah, well, it's a very strange story, but of course, D.C. is a far more complex and interesting place than a lot of people give it credit for. The D.C. Statehood Party really grew out in part of the fight against freeways, and they wanted to have a freeway system which would have made D.C. sort of like Los Angeles. And that the coalition that fought that included people like SNCC, the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee, but it also included middle-class white and black homeowners who would have been hit by the freeway in the northeast part of town. And so the Statehood Party, in a curious way, reflected that same sort of combination. It was led by, I think, one of the most underrated civil rights leaders in our history, Julius Hobson, who had an incredible record of getting things done in the area. But it was also very interesting because it was started two years after the riots, at a time in which blacks and white activists didn't get along all that well, and yet it was a party that had both blacks and whites in it. So it's quite an interesting story, and it gave me a great deal of faith in the importance of dealing with issues. Finding the right issues and pushing them and building your coalitions issues by issues.
Bobby from New Jersey is on. You're on with Sam Smith.
Yes. Patrice, I thank you for your forum. Sam Smith, I thank you for your insight. Both of you guys, I really appreciate it. I wasn't going to say anything because the way he's laying it out is really, really eye-opening, and I think that in terms of party-wise, that we have the same institutional framework for both parties. When you flip the coin, it's the same coin no matter which way you go. I also believe that we're not checking out that these groups will do anything to get to win, no matter what that is, and I don't think that portion of it is actually expounded upon. We go through suppressing the vote. We go through politics where, you know, Wall Street's robbed everybody of everything that you ever owned and still doing that up until this day. And then we say, well, you know, they're going to treat you fairly. We're going to do something exactly right. And I think that you guys hit it right on the nose. In terms of, you know, the grassroots, because that's always been where change has come from, not necessarily sticking your head up in the party, but cohesive with one another who have the same pretty much ideas or at least moving in the same direction. I'm going to ask the basic question, and then I'm going to take my answer off the air.
Okay, what's your question?
Are you actually 100% certain that we are going to turn this around, and in time enough to turn this around, seeing the agenda, and everyone may have a different perspective of what that agenda is, but turning around, making it a people's party? And that's my question.
Thank you, Bobby. Sam?
No, I don't have 100% faith in that. But I consider myself an existentialist, and that's someone who believes in taking actions and advocating things regardless of what the chances are. And I think this is very important for us to understand. They say the existentialist view is that even the dead man, the condemned man, has a choice of how to approach the gallows. And one of the examples I use on this issue is that in 1848, 300 people met in Seneca Falls, New York, for the first women's conference in our country's history. Only two of those women lived long enough to vote. And the question I ask people, would you have bothered to have gone to that meeting, or would you have considered it a waste of time? That's the issue. It's not, you know, what our chances are. We still have to react the right way, regardless of what our chances are.
You know, with regard to that meeting in Seneca, I had a different question. My question was, one of the feminists was Frederick Douglass. And when the time came, when Frederick Douglass was expecting the women's suffrage movement to back the abolition movement in the same spirit that he had backed the suffrage movement and had traveled in behalf of it, they kind of said, "Freddie, sorry, you're on your own." So this is also what we are dealing with right now, where people see that, you know, we are good with a coalition as long as you understand, A, I'm in charge, and B, it's about what I deem to be important. I don't think that the progressive movement has developed yet the maturity to fully embrace this. I mean, to be really serious about embracing the concept of equality in terms of participation and in terms of leadership.
Oh, I think there are a lot of problems along that line. And, you know, well, one of the problems is that if you examine these groups, a lot of them are competing for funds. And I think that's one of the factors that makes it more difficult at a group level for these groups to come together. But there's no doubt about it that you can't have a movement unless you're willing to if you're a feminist, to help the civil rights or the anti-war people and vice versa. It's got to be one big group. And it's interesting, living in Maine, there's a little bit of a different feeling you feel here. You know, we just passed a gay marriage referendum. And I was watching that, and I was struck by a couple of things. One was how incredibly effective the people were who worked on that. I mean, I must have gotten 6-7 calls trying to build up support for that issue. But also that there is not quite that sort of ideological group breakup here. And the Greens are a little bit stronger here, so they provide a certain coalition aspect to it. So I think the potential is there, but it is something that you see, we live in a society which has become increasingly atomized. I mean, I think, to me, the symbol of that is the iPod. You know, we all wear earphones now, or we're looking at our cell phones, that doesn't work for organizing. We got to look at each other.
Well, Sam, this has been a fantastic hour that you spent with us today,
but thanks for having me.
This is not going to be your first time. You do have to come back. We really need you to course us through the deconstruction of the Clinton era. That is so important for folks to understand that what we see is not really what is. It's a whole different story there. But I want to thank you so much.
All right, thank you. Bye now.
All righty, bye-bye. So that was Sam Smith, editor of the Progressive Review. He's going to come back, and because the story of the Clintons is a pretty long and detailed one, but it is important because so much of Clintonism is surviving in the Obama administration. I want to thank you for the pleasure and privilege of your company, and we see each other tomorrow. Don't forget, stay tuned. Coming up next is Alternative Visions with Jack Rasmus. Thanks.